Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.
What do you love about music?
To begin with, everything.
Putting on a great show is the most important thing you can do. One great rock show can change the world.
Welcome to Sound Opinions. I'm Jim DeRogatis, the pop music critic at the Chicago Sun-Times.
And I'm Greg Cott. I write about rock and roll for the Chicago Tribune. And Jim, tonight on the world's only rock and roll talk show, I love this time of year. Summer is in the air. Festival season's almost upon us here in Chicago. Big records are starting to roll out.
And, albums are falling out of the trees, yeah. Just like Keith Richards.
We're going to talk about Keith Richards in a moment, falling out of a tree, believe it or not. But big records, too, as you mentioned. The Red Hot Chili Peppers. What happened? 28 songs, a double CD.
It was supposed
big,
to be 38.
Big record.
They had to cut it down. It was supposed to be a triple CD. They've gone in the studio with Rick Rubin. A couple of really other interesting pairings, great producers and great artists. We're going to talk about those records, too. But first, as always on Sound Opinions, we have some news.
Mommy's all right, daddy's all right, they just seem a little weird. Surrender, surrender, but don't give yourself away. Hey, hey.
All right, Billboard magazine, which is nothing less than the Bible of the record industry, is calling this, quote, a case that could seismically alter the way labels and artists share the revenues from downloaded music. There are two bands that have filed a lawsuit against Sony BMG, the record, one of several remaining record conglomerates. There's only four super companies now, really, that control most of the music industry. The Allman Brothers and Rockford, Illinois' own Cheap Trick have filed a class action suit, which is seeking $25 million in damages against their label, saying that they are getting shortchanged on their cut of the profits from 99 cents per song digital downloads, which is rapidly becoming the prominent means of distribution for music in the music industry. We decided to talk to Dave Fry, who is the manager of Cheap Trick, and he's a manager of the Ramones late in their career and overseeing the Ramones catalog now still. Dave, welcome to Sound Opinions.
Thank you very much. Honored to be on the show with you guys.
So, Dave, what Sony BMG is doing to you guys, I mean, clearly you think that's a crime.
I don't know about crime, but we don't feel it's right.
Take us through. Let's give listeners a primer, Dave, because it's always revealing when you look at how the pie chart of the CD, or in this case we have a new paradigm, the pie chart of the digital download, how that's divided. What is Cheap Trick's standard royalty rate on something like a song like Surrender?
Well, yeah, there's 99 cents a tune. Apple pays 70 cents to the label.
Mm-hmm.
The label takes off 25% as a new technology charge because they're developing this. You know, they're putting in all this infrastructure to create this new delivery service. Like, you know, they have to retool the plant and take out all the vinyl making machines and put in CD burners instead.
Right.
Or that type of thing. In fact, CDs is still a new media for both Cheap Trick and the Ramones. I work for the Ramones, too.
Introduced in 1990, 1989.
Yes, you're still getting paid at the new media rate, is what you're saying.
Yeah, I think it was 87 or 88.
87, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, CDs are still a new media for us. But basically, there's the new media deduction. Then there's a container deduction of 25%. And I'm not sure what a container is in a download, but
there's no packaging.
Well,
there is
no container. I'm willing to learn about it, maybe in this lawsuit. And also, there's a breakage deduction too, which is between 10% and 15% for Ramones. It's 10%, and for some reason, for Cheap Trick, it's 15%.
Wow!
So you're getting charged for packaging and for breakage of an MP3 file.
Well, container. And
yeah,
breakage.
Container.
Yeah,
we don't
know what container is.
Yeah.
Yeah, you got to get this right.
That's
breakage.
Oh my God.
Wow. How does an MP3 break?
So, okay, somebody goes into a store and buys a Cheap Trick CD with your greatest hits on it, all of which have been paid for many times over. $15 for that CD.
Yep.
What percentage of that $15 actually gets into the band's pocket?
About 10%.
And essentially what you're saying is, what would be a fair rate on a 99-cent digital download of a song like Surrender that has been paid for many, many times over by the band at this point? What's a fair rate?
Are you thinking 10%?
Well, yeah, I mean, not something more than what it is.
Basically, it's $1, 99 cents. So you'd be making about a dime a song, but you're making 4.5 cents.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, that would seem to make sense. If only 70 cents goes from Apple to the record company, and you guys get a dime, they're still making 60 cents.
Yeah.
That's the bigger piece of the pot, bigger than Apple, bigger than the artist.
Yeah.
That's extraordinary.
So, well, Dave, what motivated you guys to file this lawsuit?
Long story, I'm old friends with Bert Holman, who's the manager of the Allman Brothers. And basically, I went to the Beacon, and I was talking to Bert about this, and he said, you know, I just went through our statement, and we were basically finishing each other's sentences.
Mm.
And a few nights later, this litigator showed up who said, you know what, you guys got a big point. And then they said, you know what, we'll take this on, and we'll do this pro bono.
Wow,
and
that's
we're doing
great.
It in behalf of all the artists on Sony that have a contract that predates 2002.
Mm.
And if we win, anybody that wants to can opt in and get their share of the settlement.
And you guys are seeking $25 million in damages, is that right?
Well, that's in behalf of all the artists on Sony.
Yeah.
So that's Dylan and Springsteen and Janis.
When you think about that, even that's low. You know?
Yeah, possibly, yeah.
Well, if nothing else, this lawsuit, I think, is going to wake the record companies up that they have to revise the way they're figuring out figures for this so-called new media, which is no longer so new. It happens to be the one revenue stream that actually shows potential for growth, where CD sales are declining year after year, digital download sales are exponentially increasing every year, and meanwhile, they're holding on to these sort of draconian royalty rates. So I got a feeling, Dave, if nothing else, this lawsuit is going to prompt the record industry to sort of look at itself.
Yeah, I really do hope that it has some kind of end positive result.
Well, thank you for taking the time, Dave. I want to note prominently here that Sony BMG has declined to comment on your lawsuit. I'm a monkey!
Keith Richards imitating an orangutan on his vacation, not just in a Rolling Stones song. We're laughing about this, but for a while there, I think we were all in pins and needles because Keith Richards injured himself while on vacation in Fiji. It's not clear exactly how, but one of the reports says that the death-defying Keith Richards fell from a coconut tree and hurt his head. He fell out of a tree. That would hurt.
Well, there's the alternate explanation is that he fell off a personal watercraft. We don't really know. The Stones camp is keeping mum on this, but just, you know, we don't wish ill upon Keith Richards. We're sorry he hurt himself. We like Keith Richards, but Keith Richards falling out of a tree is just too rich.
He can't go that way. This guy's more resilient than a cockroach, and I say that with
all
due respect.
But, you know, he has had numerous odd, freakish accidents. In 1998, he broke three ribs and punctured a lung. This is rich, too. Falling from a ladder while reaching for a book in his library. I mean, so, you know, never mind who knew Keith Richards liked coconuts. Who the hell knew Keith Richards had a library and could read and would actually want to climb to the top for something that wasn't like Penthouse Magazine?
You see, Jim, the sub subtext for all of this is that he may have given up drugs, but he's still drinking copiously. I mean, he told me the last time I interviewed him, he's drinking a fifth of vodka every day.
Yeah. Well, so, it's got medicinal purposes. That's healthy for him.
I'd be falling off ladders and falling out of palm trees, too, if I was drinking a fifth of alcohol every day, as Keith apparently is still doing. But the good news is that Keith is out of a New Zealand hospital after being checked in there after this accident in the Fiji Islands. He's out of the hospital. The blogosphere is going wild with rumors that Richard suffered more serious damage, that there may be brain surgery in his future, that he's suffering headaches. None of this can be confirmed. I can only say we wish Keith Richards the best. You know,
yeah, Mick Jagger, however, can fall off a cliff as far as I'm concerned.
I remember when I lost my mind. There was something so pleasant about that place. Even your emotions have an echo in so much space.
You're listening to Sound Opinions on Chicago Public Radio. Later on in the show, we're going to talk about new albums from Paul Simon and Brian Eno, Alejandro Escovedo, and the Red Hot Chili Peppers. But first, this record has been tearing up the English pop charts, number one for 5 weeks.
All right, tell me you're not instantly hooked. You're instantly in the mood of, like, what is that? That is the best song I've heard this year.
That's an incredible single.
Single of the year so far. It's called Crazy. It's the first single from the Gnarls Barkley debut album called Saint Elsewhere. It is all over the charts in England. In fact, it debuted at number one on the charts in the UK based solely on digital sales. We were just talking with
First
Dave Fry, the manager of Cheap Trick, about the increasing power of digital downloads as a primary vehicle for selling music.
First time
And there's
ever.
Your example.
Like when the Beatles replaced suddenly, you know, your Frank Sinatra's and your Perry Como's on the charts, this is the first time people put a record at number one just digital downloads.
Exactly. It's sweeping England. It is soon to be released in the United States. What is Gnarls Barkley? Where did this song come from? Gnarls Barkley, essentially a collaboration between a rapper vocalist named CeeLo and a DJ named Danger Mouse. CeeLo, a primary member in the rap group Goody Mob from Atlanta, also a couple of incredible solo albums. Thomas Calloway, childhood friend of Dre from Outkast from Atlanta, part Southern preacher, part cartoon character, a spiritualist, a surrealist, yeah. a guy, singer, a rapper.
Exactly. A guy who sings as much as he raps.
Absolutely.
Partners with this guy, Brian Burton, who's best known as Danger Mouse. Definitely the most inventive producer on the current hip-hop scene. Best known for the illegal but brilliant combination of Jay-Z's Black Album and the Beatles' White Album to equal the Gray Album.
And don't forget, Burton worked on that Grammy-winning album by the Gorillaz, Demon Days. That was Danger Mouse's production job on that. Also did an incredible job with MF Doom on the Danger Doom record. Burton, a.k.a. Danger Mouse, seems to find new collaborators every year to work on exciting new projects that sound nothing like what he's done before, and has done it once again with CeeLo on this Gnarls Barkley record.
Now, they would have us believe that Gnarls Barkley is, in fact, this mysterious musical Svengali, who was a great friend of the late rock critic Lester Bangs, has been a lover of Mariah Carey and Janet Jackson, and happened to have taught Kraftwerk how to speak English. They have this long, elaborate bio, which is their official Atlantic Records biography. None of it's true. It's clearly these two guys messing around in the studio. Let's play a little something, and then we're going to give our thoughts on this record.
We decided on Smiley Faces, which is one of many great tracks from the Saint Elsewhere record by Gnarls Barkley on Sound Opinions.
But what did you do? What did you say? Or did you walk or did you run away? Where are you now? Where have you been? Did you go alone or did you bring a friend? I need to know this, cause I noticed you're smiling out of the sun, having fun and feeling free. And I can tell you know how hard this life can be, but you keep on smiling for me. Was it overnight or did it take you long? Was knowing your weakness what made you strong? Or all the above? Oh, how I love to see you smile.
side. Oh, see.
Greg, I have a theory about this record. Saint Elsewhere is kind of in the name and also in the title of the single, Crazy. I think that this is a concept album, musing on what is sane and what is crazy. Mm. What do those two words mean in a world that's schizophrenic by nature? Danger Mouse, being one of the great artists who is working schizophrenia as a medium, doesn't matter what the genre is. There's an electro-pop cover of the great Violent Femmes song, Gone Daddy Gone. There's this weird ballad, Just a Thought, which is musing on suicide. You know, there's psychedelic soul, like the great Isaac Hayes chocolate-covered psychedelic classics. I mean, everything under the sun is on this record.
Yeah, I agree with you. There's an element of surrealism that is really inviting. I think Danger Mouse is an expert in this area, especially after his collaboration with MF Doom. The cartoon stuff that you quoted, you know, you can hear the Damon Albarn Gorillaz influence there in terms of the bio, the fanciful bio for this band.
Yeah.
So they're bringing some of that. And CeeLo, I mean, this guy's solo records were just mind-blowing in terms of where he wanted to go with the music.
You've been championing him on Sound Opinions for years.
Yeah. People think Outkast is blowing out the boundaries of hip-hop. I mean, this guy's solo records have been way beyond Outkast in terms of just their experimentation. You mentioned the song The Boogie Monster, you know, Ode to a Vampire. He looks in the mirror and says, hey, the monster's me, you know. I'm this guy who I can't figure out, you know. I'm this crazy guy.
And you still wonder why he looked familiar. Then I realized it was a mirror. Oh, and now it is plain to see the whole time the monster was me.
I don't think that CeeLo, as a rapper, is on the same par, not quite as great a talent as Danger Mouse is as a producer, but he is a great singer. He can do the soul R&B thing in a freaky, stylish way. You know, not great by Marvin Gaye standards, but certainly in a Prince just kind of freak funk way.
Yeah, he's got this Southern preacher thing going, and yet he's got this high tenor voice, and yet it's really gravelly at the same time. Mm-hmm. So there's a sense of, you know, you're dealing with a freak. He was in the gospel choir, but at the same time, he might have been messing around, you know, with a couple of the girls on the side. He's wearing
a blonde mop top wig and these Mr. Magoo glasses. I mean, it looks really freaky and frightening.
Yeah, it's a really inventive record, and I think that song Crazy is going to be one of the dominant songs of the summer. If there's any justice at all in the United States, this song will be a huge,
summer
huge
hit. It's a summer hit.
Absolutely.
Summer hit. On the patented Sound Opinions scale of buy it, burn it, trash it, I've got to say this is a buy it record. I love this record, Greg.
Sure, this is a buy it record all the way. And we got to have another dose of crazy before we get to some more record reviews. We're going to talk about Paul Simon, Alejandro Escovedo, the Red Hot Chili Peppers later on in the show. But first, a dose of crazy from the Gnarls Barkley record on Sound Opinions.
Come on now, who do you? Thank you.
the fireworks, rushed out to watch the sky, happy-go-lucky, 4th of July. How can you live in the Northeast? How can you live in the South? How can you build on the banks of a river when the flood water pours from the mouth? How can you be a Christian? How can you be a Jew? How can you be a Muslim, a Buddhist, a Hindu? How can you?
That is Paul Simon, the opening track from his new album, Surprise. It's called How Can You Live in the Northeast? I'm really tempted, whenever I mention this record, to say Paul Simon and Brian Eno, because it is a collaboration between the veteran Baby Boom icon, longtime singer-songwriter, and the producer, who may be best known for working with Talking Heads, or with U2, or David Bowie, also an extraordinary solo artist in his own right, Brian Eno, the godfather of the ambient movement, one of the most fascinating people in rock history, I think, one of those guys behind the scenes who's always been influencing very much what's gone on in the mainstream, even if he may not be as famous as the artist he's worked with. This is an interesting album, because it seems to me, Greg, I don't know if you'll agree, but it seems that at 64 years old, about to enter an incredible fifth decade as a huge presence in the pop world, Paul Simon's been pretty much at a loss since the beginning of his fourth decade. You know, he had that Songs from the Cape Man kind of disastrous foray into musical theater in 1997. 2000's You're the One, his ninth solo album of his career, did better. You know, it was nominated for Grammys. Some critics liked it, although I will note, neither you nor I liked it when we reviewed it on Sound Opinions. Paul Simon, as a solo artist, has not come anywhere near the peak of those great songs like Late in the Evening and 50 Ways to Leave Your Lover and Kodachrome that he had in the early 70s. He's kind of been lost for since, you know, Graceland and Rhythm of the Saints. You know, in 86 he turns to South Africa for inspiration and makes that incredible Graceland record. In 90 he turns to Brazil with Rhythm of the Saints. Where was he going to turn now? The answer is Brian Eno, who is famous. I've interviewed Eno at length, as have you. I've interviewed you, too, about working with Eno. The Edge told me memorably that Eno's role in working with you, too, on those records like Octung Baby and Zooropa would be to erase, literally erase, anything that sounded too much like what U2 had done in the past. And Eno said, you have to understand, there's this huge industry built up around a mega-selling band like U2 that it's vested in trying to make U2 continue to sound like U2. And Eno would come in, and he had carte blanche, and he would erase anything that sounded like U2. The record company hated him, but U2 welcomed him with open arms. Mm-hmm. Eno is the founder of this philosophy that the recording studio in itself is an instrument, and you should approach it with these oblique strategies. At one point in his career, he literally had cards. You don't know, you know, what is working and what's not in a song. You would pull out one of these cards, and it would make a kind of zen suggestion, like, is it finished? Or does it need the sound of water falling? And these would break down these creative blockages in the studio. I think it was a brave, brave thing for Paul Simon to turn to a guy like this, because Simon is notorious as an egotist.
Well,
he likes to be right.
I think both guys have a sense of who they are, and God willing, everybody else will follow their lead.
Or else.
Exactly. And Simon is notorious for that, as is Eno, I think, to an extent. Eno does not truck fools. I'm amazed, in fact, that these two guys actually got along.
And didn't kill
each
other.
And made a record out of it. Well, you've set it up very well, Jim, and I think this is a very, very intriguing record. I think we got to play a track, and there's a lot to discuss here. I think it's going to be an interesting debate as to how we feel about this record.
Let me give a little context for this song. It's called Wartime Prayers. It's obviously a song about the tragedy of war. It joins, I think, the songs we talked about last week from Neil Young on his new album, Living with War, in being non-judgmental about who's right and who's wrong, and talking about people on both sides suffering. Although Simon, as is his wont, is a little angrier. He talks about, I think it's a line about the 9/11 attacks, where he's talking about, you know, gone like a memory from the day before the fires. People are hungry for the voice of God. But in the end, he says, you know, wartime prayers in every language spoken for every family scattered and broken. It's a very emotional song. I think it kind of taps into the same vibe of The Sounds of Silence, which he wrote in the middle of the killing in Vietnam. Here it is on Sound Opinions, Wartime Prayers from Paul Simon and Brian Eno.
Prayers offered in times of peace
our silent conversations, appeals for love or love's release, in private invocations. But all that is changed now. Like a memory from the day before the fires, people hungry for the voice of God. Hear lunatics and liars. Wartime prayers, wartime prayers.
Wartime prayers from Paul Simon's 10th album, Surprise, and I think the high point of this record. You can hear the dramatic Eno input there, taking that sort of very gentle, wispy ballad and transforming it into this very dramatic and beautiful ballad.
Yeah, when the gospel choir comes in, what
and,
a powerful
and,
moment.
You know, people say, what do these guys have in common? Well, Eno and Simon, I think, both share a real love for gospel singing.
Mm-hmm.
That influences on both their records throughout their careers, and you really hear it in this beautiful song.
Well, and an
prayers.
Appreciation of rhythm.
Absolutely. Simon, very underrated in that area. The percolating Brazilian grooves on Rhythm of the Saints, the percolating South African grooves on Graceland,
yeah.
Eno as well. Amazing with what he can do with rhythm. Also, the mix, the multidimensional mix, foreground, the middle ground, the distant horizon. He arrays these instruments in really interesting ways, and he's very subtle in the way he does it.
This is where I thought he and Simon might clash, because Simon likes his vocal to be front and center, and Eno's mixes are famous for the vocal may be subservient to a snare drum
mm-hmm.
or an odd guitar part. And there's a lot of great odd guitar on this record from Bill Frisell.
Mm-hmm. Simon as well. Simon, a very underrated guitar player, does a lot of the guitar playing here, allowed Eno to treat his guitars.
Herbie Hancock is playing keyboards, and
yep.
you have Steve Gadd, longtime Simon sideman on drums, who's considered, you know, the preeminent studio drummer of all time.
So the stars were aligned. This record could have been a masterpiece. I think it could have been an amazing record, and if every song had been as good as Wartime Prayers and a couple of the other ones, I think you would have knocked it out of the park.
You're not going to, could have been. You're
I
not
think they, I think they tiptoed around each other too much. I think Eno tiptoed around Simon, and I think Simon, the Simon ego maybe got in the way a little
bit
here.
You're breaking my heart.
I wish it had been better. You know, you talk about the rhythm. Where's the rhythm in this record, Jim? That's what I'm really missing.
It's the ambient percolation thing that Eno does. Very, very subtle.
And, you know, we get the wispy Simon vocals, the gentle melodies, and the songs just sort of sit there. You know, and it's a nice bubble bath to be in. But I found myself getting a little antsy listening to this record, saying, take me somewhere.
What, is there a
you know,
full
the
moon
drama
or something?
There's
a full moon. So you're saying this record doesn't rock enough, and Jim DeRogatis here is defending a Paul Simon record. It's like it's the topsy-turvy universe.
Wartime Prayers doesn't rock, but it's dramatic, and it takes me somewhere. You saw the way that song transformed itself, even in the couple of minutes we were listening to it. And I don't hear that sense of transition on a lot of these other songs. They sort of stay in one place. And
Eno's
decorations are really pretty. I mean, I think he does a tremendous job, very subtle. I think he tiptoed around Simon a little bit too much. I think Simon demanded sort of a dramatic reinvention here, very similar to what Eno did with Talking Heads.
Hey, I'll
very
tell you
similar that, to what he did with U2. He didn't pull it off with Simon.
I don't know if I agree with that, because I think it's a dramatic reinvention. I am not a Simon fan, you know, aside mm-hmm. from a couple of singles from the early 70s, which I mentioned earlier. I like Graceland, okay. I don't like Rhythm of the Saints, and I really don't like Paul Simon. My wife, who is a Simon fan, heard me playing this record several times and didn't even realize it was Paul Simon.
Right.
Maybe that's why I like it. But I don't know what you're talking about, Greg. I think that all the best Simon traits are here. I'm shocked. I thought you'd be all over this record. And then I think that if the Sound Opinions team was consulted going into this, they'd say, this is one of those ones. Greg's going to like it. Jim's going to say, you know.
The fact that 80% of your introduction reaction about a Paul Simon record had to do with Brian Eno makes me wonder if it really mattered whether Paul Simon was on this record or not.
No, I think it's irrelevant.
Talk about the cult of the producer.
No, it's a Brian Eno record that Paul Simon happens to sing
exactly.
on.
Exactly.
You know, and I love this record. It's a buy-it record as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, it's three or four good songs, definitely worth burning, but a snoozy. Snoozy record. Burn it all the way.
Wow.
Down from telling stories, strolling through the neighborhood, clanking steel and discolored, because you made a truce of rubber, because you made a truce. You see a butt from the sky, trample.
Alejandro Escovedo, The Boxing Mirror, that is a song, Notes on Air, from his new album produced by John Cale. Cale is a hero of Alejandro Escovedo's. Alejandro, when he was growing up in California in the late 60s, went to see the Velvet Underground play, a band that John Cale co-founded, and they remained an inspiration for him throughout his career. When he went to San Francisco in the late 70s, he formed one of the very first punk bands on the West Coast, The Nuns, and went from there to be a founding member of Rank and File, the cow punk band out of California. Also was a key member of the True Believers, a guitar-based band sort of in the mold of the New York Dolls and Mott the Hoople. Two more of his heroes in Texas during the mid-80s. A long solo career beginning in the early 90s. The Boxing Mirror, his latest album, combining many of the influences that he has shown throughout his career. A little bit of that country influence that he had in Rank and File, a little bit of that punk influence that he had in The Nuns. Later on, went to work with string arrangements and went to one of the best string arrangers in the planet with John Cale, whose viola was a defining instrument in the Velvet Underground. So it appears to be a match made in heaven, at least from Escovedo's standpoint, a long time singer-songwriter, now based in Texas, and finally coming up with a record where he sort of melds all of the influences throughout his 30-year career into one place at one time. It's called The Boxing Mirror. Here's a track from it, reflecting back on his days when he was in his very first band, The Nuns, Sacramento and Polk on Sound Opinions.
That is Sacramento and Polk by Alejandro Escovedo from his new album, Boxing Mirror. What was that, the address of where the Nuns rehearsed, Greg?
One of the hotels, one of the sort of cheap divey hotels in San Francisco that they used to stay, where a lot of nasty activity was carried out.
Well, you definitely hear that Velvet Underground groove, the rhythm, and the way the guitars just slap you in the face. It's a great track. I have not been a fan of Alejandro Escovedo's solo career, Greg. Craig. He's known for those lush strings that you mentioned. I have an anti-singer-songwriter thing to begin with, but I like the Paul Simon record, so I'm not inflexible. It's a little precious sometimes, his lyrics. I like him very much when he's paying homage to his Mexican roots and bringing in kind of this weird combination of Lou Reed circa Street Hassle with the strings and Mexican influences. That's great. So I liked the bands that made him a cult hero, the Nuns, Rank and File, True Believers, been lukewarm on the solo career. I think this is his best solo album. You hear Cale come on loud and strong. It rocks really hard. But then there's also other stuff like that song, The Ladder, is a beautiful, beautiful, fairly traditional Mexican ballad. I think the thing that you forgot to mention in your introduction that is key to why this album works, besides John Cale, is that Alejandro survived a life-threatening illness just a couple of years ago. He had hepatitis C, broke down in Arizona, I think, while on tour. There's a song here that very frighteningly conveys what happened there. It nearly died. There was a 2004 tribute benefit album called Por Vida, where you had some of the cream of the crop of the roots rock scene of America covering his songs and trying to help him pay his hospital bills. So there's two things happening here. He's working with his hero and really getting into that Velvet's garage rock drone mode, and he's happy to be alive. It's kind of a theme that runs throughout the whole album. Gonna learn how to give, not how to simply get by or to barely hang on, he says close to the end in a song called Died a Little Today. This is a guy who, you know, like Keith Richards, he's just had, one of his nine lives, wasn't sure he was going to get the chance, and man, he's happy to be here and happy to rock.
Yeah, well, you're absolutely right about the recovery from the hepatitis C. He is happy to be alive. You know, he's in his mid-50s. He didn't think he was going to get another chance. He literally did not think he was going to be able to play music again 2 years ago, much less be alive. And in much in the same way that Neil Young seems to have had suddenly a second life after his brain aneurysm of last year, or Dylan in 97,
yeah,
coming off that heart ailment and suddenly making one of the best records of his career, you get the sense of Escovedo as a man renewed on this record.
I'm sensing a new rule. You know, there's that old cliche that death is a good career move in rock and roll.
Yeah.
But near death
is a better
living
move.
and making a great album is an even better move. That's
exactly
great. You don't die, you make good art.
And you point out the flaws in his earlier studio career, and I'm inclined to agree with you to an extent. I think the live shows have always eclipsed the albums. Finally, he got a chance to do a little serious studio time with somebody who really understood him as an artist. And Cale is an admirer of Escovedo's. He recorded a key song on the Por Vida tribute album. He clearly admires Escovedo as a songwriter, and he understands what he's trying to get at, because he's tried to make these kind of complex records with the Mexican influences, the string arrangements, the punk side, the country side. How do you meld all those things and make it sound coherent? And I think Cale understood that about him, and he got the formula right on this record.
Yeah, when you hear those guitars roaring like they were on that track we played, you know, there's also, you know, Mexican accordion, and it sounds just, you know, like it belongs with those guitars. I don't think that's ever sounded like those things belong together on an Escovedo record.
So I've had people email me, Jim, and say, you know, you're clearly a fan of Escovedo. You've written about him several times. Where do you start? I'd say this record. I tell them, go out and get the Boxing Mirror, because it's probably the best recorded record and the best representation of all the things he's been interested in musically in his career, finally nailed in the studio. By all means, see this guy on tour. He's touring again for the first time in many years since his Hep C sort of kicked in big time. He's finally able to tour with some regularity, and a live show that's definitely worth seeing, the way he combines the punk guitars with the strings. Susan Vells, a longtime member of Poi Dog Pondering, is a key member of his band and also a member of a key part of this record.
Plays violin.
You hear her playing. Cale took her out of her comfort zone on this record.
Mm.
He said, you're going to play some stuff that maybe you don't like.
Yeah.
The riff in Deerhead on the Wall was Cale's idea, and Vells, this classically trained musician, was kind of buckling, saying, I'm not sure that sounds very good, but it turned out to be the key hook in the song.
Well, that's what Eno and Cale shared in common. Both producers like to kick people out of their comfort zones, which is probably why they didn't work together so well. But I think it's a buy it record, easily.
Yep. On the buy it, burn it, trash it scale, buy it as well for me.
All right, we're going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to talk about the much-anticipated Red Hot Chili Peppers double album, Stadium Arcadium, and Greg is going to have a Desert Island Jukebox selection on Sound Opinions on Chicago Public Radio.
Ready made, steady as a rhythm roll. sweet Louisiana, robbing on a bank in the state of Indiana. She's a runner, rebel and a stunner, on the mirror way saying, baby, what you gonna? Looking down the barrel of a hot man 45, just another way to survive.
That is the Red Hot Chili Peppers with the first single from their epic double album, Stadium Arcadium. The song is called Danny California. She is apparently a young woman who last made her appearance in a Chili Peppers song in Californication. Anthony Kiedis and the Chili Peppers sing about basically how inferior life is anywhere else besides Venice Beach, California, and how wonderful life is there. Much is being made of this, this being originally a triple album. They recorded some 38 songs that they trimmed down to a mere 28 on this double record, Stadium Arcadium. Also, they recorded it in a house once owned by Harry Houdini. As if somehow the magic permeated this record. I don't believe that happened at all. I think that the biggest trick that the Red Hot Chili Peppers have ever pulled is making a 23-year career now out of the most marginal and meager of talents. That and the fact that they completely reinvented themselves. It began circa 1990s Blood, Sugar, Sex, Magic, where all of a sudden this group that had been punk, funk, frat party, house party, you know, hard rockin', noisy party meisters, suddenly started recording ballads. Now, 18 of the 28 songs on this album, I would categorize one degree or another as ballads. That leaves, you know, very little of the party hardy funk. Let's hear an example of a song that is typical. It's called Especially in Michigan on Sound Opinions.
Especially in Michigan from the Red Hot Chili Peppers, the new album Stadium Arcadium. Anthony Kiedis, a little tribute, a backhanded slap in the face, really, to his home state of Michigan. Midwesterner in his youth and moved out to Cali and saw the light and decided that California, their muse, the scene of many, many destructive catastrophes in their life as well. I mean, Kiedis has sung very openly about his abuse of drugs, his catastrophic relationships. The theme of this new album is that Kiedis is making the transformation into a more spiritually enlightened human being.
I've read that it's inspired by the Kabbalah, that mystical Jewish religious teaching which Madonna's been hyping.
Yeah.
I mean, Kiedis, as a lyricist, he has nothing worth saying and certainly nothing that would make you think of the Kabbalah.
I think he shows his true colors in a song like She's Only 18. You know, the barely legal, She's Only 18. I put my lovin' in your oven. I mean, these guys jumped around the stage like a bunch of chimps in the 80s, as you put it, made this remarkable transformation into balladeers. The melodic balladeer side of them is still in full operation on this record. I have a tough time swallowing.
Yeah.
I have a tough time swallowing the sensitivity that they seem to be evincing toward the opposite gender here.
Well, there's the song that Flea wrote for Kiedis to propose to a girlfriend, and then there's, it's too much.
Now, 2 points that I need to make about the Chili Peppers, because I'm very dubious about them. They did become a very reliable singles band in the 90s. I think some of the better alternative rock hits of the 90s were written by the Chili Peppers. Under the Bridge, Scar Tissue, Californication, Give It Away. Those songs didn't sound bad coming on the radio, and in small doses, this band can be interesting. They've got a few potential hits on this record, but 28 songs is a lot of songs, way more Chili Peppers than anybody needs.
Especially because they keep repeating themselves.
Oh, my God. It really is kind of a very repetitive record. I think this is a big screw-up on the part of the producer, Rick Rubin, who was notorious for his high standards as a songwriting coach. I mean, he's worked with some of the best. He's worked with Johnny Cash. He's worked with System of a Down. And it's a pretty wide range. I mean, he's gotten some great work out of the Beastie Boys, for God's sakes. And the Chili Peppers. He's sort of been
their guru.
He got the Chili Peppers on the radio with albums like Californication and Blood Sugar Sex Magik. I think his standards fell down on this record, though. The best part of this record, as far as I'm concerned, is not Anthony Kiedis' lyrics or his newfound sensitivity, but John Frusciante's guitar playing.
Yeah.
I think he's a remarkable guitar player, and I think he adds a lot to this record. I think guitar players will be listening to this record to hear moments like in the song Turn It Again, the way he sort of just takes that song over, the counter melody he plays in Desecration Smile. Are really profound, striking guitar moments on this record.
Yeah, he's a really good guitarist.
Absolutely.
Up to the equivalent of anybody who ever played with Parliament or Funkadelic, mm-hmm. those great psychedelic George Clinton records.
Yeah, he's bridging the gap. You know, Hendrix, Ernie Isley, that's the mode he's playing.
But it's not enough to make you buy this record.
Well, it's the songwriting isn't there.
No.
I'm sorry, it's not there.
No, there's a couple of moments that, like you said, will sound okay on the radio, but that's like the best you can say about it. And 18 ballads that sound all sort of samey with Kiedis' kind of mush mouth vocals and his stupid lyrics and Flea overplaying the bass and the rhythm section stuck in that mid-tempo mode and Frusciante only let out of his cage once in a while.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, this is a trash it record. I would maybe be on the cusp of saying burn it, but let's face it, you're going to hear enough of it on the radio. You don't need to even own it in any shape or form, whether you're buying it or sampling it. So it's otherwise, trash it, and it'll come in through the ether anyway.
I think there's a couple of burn it moments on this record, but my God, I cannot see anybody spending hard-earned money for this record. There's no way. Trash it. I think 28 songs, I can count maybe six that I want to hear again.
Of all the bands to be surviving from the alternative era,
we get stuck with these guys?
Why has there been 23 years of Red Hot Chili Peppers?
I tell you, little buddy, this whole island is bewitched.
You remember, we were shipwrecked together.
Each week, when we have a little bit of room left in the show, either Greg or I takes a turn at popping a quarter into the Desert Island Jukebox, talking about a track that we could not live without. Mr. Cott, it is your turn.
Well, Jim, as is our pattern with the DIJs on the show, we want to sort of accomplish more than just play a great record, but sort of tie it into something else that happened in the show or should have happened in the show. And one of the people we wanted to pay tribute to on Sound Opinions tonight was Phil Walden, who was a major behind-the-scenes player in the music industry for decades, died at the age of 66 a few weeks ago, perhaps best known as the founder of Capricorn Records in the South, the great Southern rock label, and putting the Allman Brothers on the map, was a big contributor into the Jimmy Carter campaign in the mid-70s, and was notable for the way he sort of bridged the gap between Southern rock, the White House, giving legitimacy to both in some ways. You know, Jimmy Carter got a whole new generation of
voters. And really, the first time you had a rock figure, you know, being counted as someone who was, you know, could have his picture taken next to the president.
Absolutely.
I mean, that did not happen before.
Absolutely. So the guy that discovered Duane Allman, not a bad legacy, but I think even more importantly, in a lot of ways, the manager of Otis Redding. Walden was very shrewd, very canny in the way that he sort of expanded Otis Redding's career as a soul singer, the baby boomer icon soul singer of the 60s. And I think a lot of that has to do with the way Phil Walden managed Redding's career. One of the things he did was set up Otis Redding to play the Monterey Pop Festival in 1967, the Summer of Love, 67. Otis Redding made his reputation with the elusive white audience. He'd been selling a lot of R&B records to African Americans in the 60s, but really had not reached that white audience where the money was, let's face it, until he played the Monterey Pop Festival and blew people away with that performance. Unfortunately, a few months later, Redding died in that plane crash in December of 67. Ironically, a few weeks later, having his biggest hit of his career, the number one song, Dock of the Bay. But Walden also did another very shrewd thing, and that is put Otis Redding and the entire key players on the Stax roster. Stax Records, the famous R&B label out of Memphis for which Redding recorded, got him on the road, had him play Europe in 67, and these guys were competing with each other on that road trip. It wasn't just a case of, you know, we're all friends here. They were trying to outdo each other on the stage. And preceding Otis Redding on the stage was Sam and Dave, who a lot of people thought one of the best live acts of all time. Sam and Dave just smoking on stage. What could Otis Redding do to top them? Well, Phil Walden had him record a Rolling Stones song, had him record Satisfaction. You can only imagine how that went over with the European audience. Here's this black Southern R&B artist playing a big rock hit by one of the England's biggest bands at the time, and it went over like gangbusters. He also covered a Beatles song. So Walden kind of cannily placing Otis Redding in people's minds with these kind of very smart decisions about what kind of songs to record.
Walden, not Otis himself, making those decisions?
Walden, I would say, it was an advisory role in the same way that John Landau has sort of steered Bruce Springsteen's career. I think Walden did the same thing with Otis Redding. Otis Redding, let's not underestimate how smart this guy was, though. Not only did Otis Redding write most of his biggest hits, he also arranged and produced them. I mean, this guy had a tremendous ear for horns and how they could be used in a R&B song. I think he revolutionized the way horns sounded and were used on R&B songs. And ever since, the Otis Redding model, I think, has been the way horns have been used in R&B.
And, records. Of course, a one-of-a-kind voice.
Absolutely. One of the great singers, one of the most expressive singers of all time. But I'm not going to play Satisfaction or his cover of the Beatles' Day Tripper. I'm going to play a song that he wrote, Can't Turn You Loose. And you're going to hear it on that European tour in the spring of 67. He's just been challenged by Sam and Dave. They have come out and smoked that audience. Otis Redding is going to try to one-up Sam and Dave, which was a tough thing to do. But he had a great backing band, Booker T and the MGs. He had a great horn section, and he sped it up, like about to 10 times its normal speed. With Al Jackson, it sounded like he was pounding nails. This is Can't Turn You Loose, one of Otis Redding's greatest performances from the European tour of 67 on Sound Opinions.
Ah! going one time. Whopping now. Hit it, boy! Keep the groove going. Keep it going. Don't stop. Keep the groove going.
Otis Redding revving it up with Booker T and the MGs, Can't Turn You Loose, on the European tour of 67. Man, that's got me in a great mood, and also putting me in a great mood was this band that is going to perform for us next week, Art
We
Brute.
Taped him a couple weeks ago, Art Brute from England, one of your favorite bands of the year. I love this record. They're fun to talk to, fun to listen to.
Absolutely. It's going to be a fun show with them, and we're happy to introduce them to a large part of our audience. Their record is just now coming out in the United States after being out in England for more than a year. So it'll be fun to have these guys play for us next week.
There you go. We've got some thank yous to say on the way out. As always, our executive producer is Tori Malatia. Our managing producer and director is Todd Bachman. Our producer is Matt Spiegel. Associate producers are Jason Saldana and Robin Lynn. We get some legal help from Dino Armiro, some technical assistance from Joe Dassault. And we'd just like to thank you for listening, and see you next week.